Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Isha Prava, who has been a spiritual seeker since she was quite young. And in 1969 at Stanford University, she heard Swami Kriyananda speak for the first time and immediately recognized him as her spiritual guide. As a result of that, she became a founding member of the new community Swami was starting near Nevada City, California, called Ananda Village. And in fact, she has lived in Ananda communities and studied with Swami for nearly 40 years. Are you there?
I'm right here, Mike.
That's very good. I can hear you nice and clear. Now,
good.
Did I get your first name right? Is it Isha? Ishi, rather?
It's Isha Praver.
Oh, Isha, right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. I wasn't sure how to pronounce that A.
Now,
you clearly had a very interesting life from what I can read, and you've just released a book called, it's about behavior changes, and you talk about the changes that people are facing in their life, particularly now, and you've got some very good tips and steps to help them create a lasting change. Now, but what I'd firstly like to ask you is, what is it like living in these communities? What is a sort of typical day?
Well, the spirit of the communities is to make, essentially to live a life that's very recognizable, a normal life, so to speak. It's not like a convent or some peculiar lifestyle. It's more to take what people would consider to be the things that are desirable, having a home, having a family, having an interesting career, being a creative person, but infuse those with the more spiritual understanding, primarily through the personal practice of yoga, of meditation and yoga, but above all with an understanding of the higher purpose of what we're doing. So our communities over the course of time, when I first came here in 1971, we were a rural piece of land with very little on it, living in extremely primitive conditions. But over the course of these decades, we've built many nice homes, simple but nice homes. We have developed schools for our children. We run a year-round yoga retreat. We have many different business enterprises. We have a publishing house. So essentially what we've done is we've created a village. We call it Ananda Village. It's everything that society needs, except done simpler and done with friends and done with a divine awareness at the center of it, which makes the whole feeling of it completely different.
Yes. Is it open to anybody to visit?
Oh, yes. We have a retreat called The Expanding Light. Anybody who wants to search it on the internet, Expanding Light. The community is called Ananda, A-N-A-N-D-A. And if you look it up, you'll see a vast number of resources. Just basically, you know, I think that the lifestyle that we have here in this community, and now we have seven others, I've actually helped start two of them. I live actually now, this is, the village is a rural community, and in Palo Alto, California, south of San Francisco, we have an urban version of the same thing, where what we did is we took a master lease on an apartment complex and basically converted that whole apartment complex into a community so that almost everybody who lives there, they're either dedicated to meditation and yoga practice or they're compatible with it. And all of your neighbors are your friends. All of your neighbors' children are sort of your children. It's the kind of image of life that people think of when they think of small town America. Except when you go backwards in time, it didn't necessarily have an uplifted quality to it. It was just a small town. It had many good features. People knew each other. There was a human scale to it. But what we've done is replicate that with an idealistic center, which is that people are all living there because of their desire to be more conscious in their lives, to be more responsible spiritually, ecologically, and in every other way. But it's very difficult in our society now to make changes on a mass scale. The whole thing is sort of out of our control. So going back to a small scale where we can actually influence the course of our small society is, I think, really the solution, the wave of the future.
Yes.
You asked what life is like, and a typical day is like a typical day would be for anyone, just depending on what your job and your work is. The difference being that almost everyone starts their day with meditation. There is a sense of friends and family all around you. Like, it's a very large extended family, so that when you just walk out of your, wherever your personal living space is, whether it's a room or an apartment or a house, you walk out and everybody that you see around you is somebody that you know well. It's amazing how much difference it makes to have depth of relationship with the people around you. Just think how many people in an urban setting, which is where I live now, once I leave the community, I don't know who anybody is. I don't know their lives, I don't know their character, I don't know their names.
No.
Whereas in the community, especially in the village, which is a much larger community, you know everybody. And so you're always moving around in this sort of rich sea of relationships.
Yes.
It's very, very different.
So does everyone have a particular responsibility to make the community work?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear your question. Would you repeat it again?
Does everyone in the community have their own responsibilities to make the whole thing work?
Well, we've never required any kind of participation from people. We felt it's always been better to make what we're doing magnetic and let people participate because they want to. So some people's actual job, the financial system we work is the one we're used to. People work for salaries, get money, and basically pay rent or fees or make contributions out of their own private money. We don't have a communal economic system. So many people have jobs that are actually community related, community manager, managing the guest retreat, cooking in one of the community kitchens, taking care of the community gardens. Other people, these days, they'll telecommute to a high-tech job. Some people are craftsmen of various kinds, and they just do their own work in their own way. But everybody contributes in the sense that we entertain ourselves. We have a lot of music. We have a lot of artistic activities and events. We have, a rich social life. We have schools for our children, so we have a lot of activities around the children. And people volunteer and participate because it's their own family. In the same way that if your family comes over for a picnic, everybody gets involved because it's your own story. It's not like going somewhere and having someone else do it for you. It's just us.
Yes. Yeah. Now, you say you start the day with meditation.
Yes.
I've taken part in different types of meditations. What type do you do?
Well, our whole community is based on the teachings of Paramhansa Yogananda. Yogananda wrote a book called Autobiography of a Yogi. And his basic meditation technique is called Kriya Yoga, which in itself just means a particular action that leads to divine realization. And so it's a particular kind of meditation that is more than just a technique, it's a worldview. And the worldview is that the divine spirit dwells within each of us, and that our happiness comes from our attunement with the presence of the divine within us, and there's specific things we can do, actions, attitudes, spiritual techniques, that will bring us into greater awareness and harmony with that. And then it gets more esoteric the more you get into it. You learn how to really interiorize your energy, how to work with the chakras, how to work with the kundalini energy, which are all of the subtle energies within us. And so you can sort of take it from the surface, or you can get very deep into it. And so we follow pretty much, most of the people here follow that particular teaching as disciples with a lot of focused commitment.
Right. You spoke about teaching, which you do yourself.
Uh-huh.
What type of subjects do you teach?
Well, when I came here when I was a young woman in my early 20s, I felt that there just had to be a better way to live. You know,
yes.
Nowadays, I think you and I are contemporaries, and we sort of were earlier earlier in this movement of people looking around and thinking there just has to be a better way to live with nature, to live with God, to live with each other. I had to, of course, learn how myself to be in harmony with these higher realities. And so pretty much what I do teach now and have taught for since fairly early on is the harmonious awareness expanding approach to just about everything, from educating children to having a marriage relationship to being a creative artist to making money, and then of course in self-acceptance to resolving psychological issues, and then of course the art of meditation itself is fundamental, and prayer and deepening your relationship with God and developing intuition. The remarkable thing about this particular spiritual path is that because it started as communities, it's always been holistic in its approach, because if you're living in community, everything about your life is involved. It's not like you just go somewhere to learn some particular little aspect like healing or psychic ability. This is like every day, every hour of every day, you're immersed in this. So we've had to come up with the way to bring the right spirit into every aspect. And I've been teaching all of that, really, you know, everywhere for many, many years now. I've been very, very, very fortunate in being able to have this be both my life and my work, really my whole life.
Right. Now, your husband is Tony, is he not?
Say it one more time.
Your husband?
Yes.
Is Tony?
I just couldn't catch your last word. My husband is?
His name?
His name is David.
David, I beg your pardon.
That's all right. That's why I was confused. Uh-huh.
Right. Does he also follow your same interests and work in the community?
Yes, he started independently and then he came to Ananda a few years after I did, and
right.
We were just a very natural partnership, and so we've been not only married to each other, but we've worked together, and now we actually for the last half of my life, for the last 20 years, in the Palo Alto area, my husband David and I together have developed a community, a teaching center, a temple, a school for children, a bookstore, sort of all the elements of Ananda right in the middle of Silicon Valley, which has been a really fun experiment to bring it focus there.
Right.
And now, the main, you know, I'm talking a lot about community, but the point of these communities,
yes.
I mean, only so many people can live in community, but it's an example of taking control over your own life and setting the direction from the inside and not feeling compelled by circumstances to live in ways that don't feel harmonious to you. And that's really what this is about.
Right. In your book, which is, I'm looking for the title now.
It's about my teacher, Swami Kriyananda, as we have known him.
That's right, okay. I've got a few notes here, and I was trying to find the total, the
that's
title
right.
of it.
Uh-huh.
Right. Now, you talk, or give a lot of advice in the book. You talk about meditating and also to be in the moment. Now, what does that mean? How can you be in the moment?
Oh, it's a very, very good question. I know, you know, Eckhart Tolle wrote the whole book called Now, so it's a big subject. If you stop and think about what your experience of life is, we realize that what we're always experiencing is what is going on inside of our own head, so to speak. We live and we work together and we have all these relationships, but the filter for all of it is really what you would call your own consciousness, your own perspective on what's happening. And oftentimes in people's lives, the direction of one's energy is so scattered between worrying about things that happened in the past, anticipating things that are going to happen in the future, imagining things that you might like to have happen, imagining things that you don't want to have happen, that oftentimes we really miss the actual day-to-day, moment-to-moment experience of what's right in front of us. We drift away or we blank out. And you'll come to in an hour or two and realize that you don't really know what's been going on. Or when we're trying to work, we can't really bring our energy to a focus. The concept of living in the now is taking all of the energy we have and keeping it concentrated on whatever the task at hand is. If it's work, if it's relaxation, if it's simply having a conversation with someone, it's just not letting our energy go in so many other directions that we're not able to give our best to what's right in front of us.
Right. I can understand that. Is this where you also advise people to stay centered for the same reason?
Yes, exactly. You know, we just get battered about by a lot of unconsidered thoughts in the sense that they just take us over and we've never really decided to have them or worked hard to get rid of them if we don't like them. The art of right living, I say, is ever-increasing awareness, to become more and more conscious of who we are, of where our happiness comes from, of what we're doing that makes us unhappy and what we're doing that does make us happy, and then developing the ability to focus our energy in such a way that our happiness increases.
Yes. Yeah. Does that necessarily mean that we have to have some spiritual goal in mind?
Well, you know, sometimes people get really confused by words. All the teaching that I've done over these years, I'm a devotee in the sense that I have a relationship with my understanding of God. I tend to think of her as a divine mother.
Yes.
I feel very comfortable with the word God. I don't have that concept confused with any religion or dogma. To me, I came to it first within my own heart, and then I found out what to call it. But people will come to me, and they'll be, I don't believe in God, I don't want to have anything to do with religion. You know, and they'll have all these reasons why they're against stuff like that. And I say, just fine. That's no problem. Let's not worry about what you don't want. Let's just talk about what you do want. And let's be honest to our own experience about what you do want. And then most people, we gradually find that somehow or another, we need to develop an inner reality. Because unless we have some inwardly directed reality, or be able to relate to the world from some position of inner strength, it's very difficult to gain any kind of mastery over our life experience. And if we're honest about our experience, we generally begin to feel that inner reality is a bigger consciousness than what I normally just call myself. And then pretty soon you get back to words like spirit, spiritual, and sooner or later you get to words like God.
Yes.
If you're really going deep into that inner reality. And I know people try to do it without wanting to be spiritual, but I say forget the vocabulary and concentrate on the experience.
Yes. And that way they will still find their God within.
Yes, exactly. Religion has confused the issue because much of religion is so external and some of it is so dogmatic that it's not attractive. It's not really what we're looking for. What we're looking for is freedom and bliss, and that has to be found within.
Yes. Now, you also talk about accessing our nature. What is that?
Our inner nature, do you mean?
Well, I don't know whether you were referring to our inner nature.
Or to the...
I guess you were, yes.
Or also just accessing, you know, the spirit in the natural world. You know, nature can be used both ways. I guess what I mean by that is all of the Indian scriptures, which Paramhansa Yogananda and my teacher Swami Kriyananda, Kriyananda is an American, but the tradition is from India, and the ancient scriptures of India have this wonderful word, which translates into English as God, but it's a much better word than God. The word is Sat Chit Ananda, and it means ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new joy. Mm-hmm. And the fundamental teaching is that all of creation and our own human nature is made up of Sat Chit Ananda, which is,
yes,
it's ever-existing, it's eternal, it's aware, and it's blissful. And what we do is we impose upon ourselves all of these conditions. We worry about this, we worry about that, we suffer from this and that. And some of those things aren't easy to overcome. I'm not being naive here. But the fact is, when we allow all limiting conditions to be removed, what's left is Sat-Chit Ananda, which is bliss, ever-existing bliss. And that's what we have to gain access to. We have to find our own source of self-generated happiness, especially nowadays, because, you know, things are becoming quite unpredictable, and the securities that people have built up for themselves do not look nearly as secure as they did.
Mm.
And so the question is, do we go down with the ship, or do we find an inner wellspring that will enable us to face difficult times and deal with whatever challenges might come, but without losing our inner sense of happiness.
Yes. Now, what do you mean by we should manifest abundance? Because I would guess that some people might think that you're talking about wealth.
Well, money is certainly a useful thing to have in the world. I mean, Yogananda, who was supremely practical, made the simple statement. He said, every good, noble, or philanthropic work in this world sooner or later comes down to a matter of money. And I have always appreciated that, because I've helped create, you know, over 40 years, quite a few things that weren't there. And yes, they all come down to a matter of money. Sooner or later, that's the way this world works. Either you earn it or you have to attract it. Some way or another, you have to get it. And so the ability to understand the energy flow, which is money, and to understand the energy flow, energy itself, is an extremely important human skill. A great deal of misery is caused because people don't understand how to manifest. Now, I take it a step further and say that financial wealth alone is not wealth. It's just money. So I think that what we need to learn to manifest is abundance, which is the abundance of everything. And I personally believe and have lived by the principle that if we manifest the right energy all along, which includes being serviceful and practical and honorable and hardworking, then everything else will follow. Too often, unfortunately, people say, you know, just basically do the phrase is do what you love, and the money will follow, but that's not necessarily true. You also have to be practical. You have to also work hard. You have to work smart, and you have to be honorable. And then you can manifest. I've never had much in my life, and the Ananda communities are remarkable for manifesting enormously without ever having any money. In the sense that we are just, even though, you know, we're quite successful, there's about 1,000 people living in the Ananda communities,
really?
We never really have much money. We have everything we need. And we live in ways that many people don't live. We travel a lot and live a very rich life, but we never have much money. We just have what we need.
Yes. Do you believe in the laws of attraction?
Oh, absolutely. This whole world is just this whole world is energy. Energy relates to magnetism. Energy responds to magnetism. Magnetism is, you know, the conscious force that you put out. And much more than people have any idea, everything in their life is determined by the laws of attraction, or the laws of attraction in reverse, the repelling force that we create. People are very casual about their thoughts and very casual about their attitudes and their feelings, and they have no idea that on a moment-to-moment basis, you are creating the magnetic field that is determining your fate. And whatever magnetic field you're creating around you, that's what you're going to attract. There's no such thing as an irrelevant thought. Everything matters.
Yes, yes. And I guess on a collective scale, we are actually creating the future for the human race.
To a certain extent, I think that's true. I believe there's a divine force, and we are acting in cooperation with that. I don't think that the human ego alone is the determining factor, but I think we're creating a collective, let me see how to say this. I think that destiny is created by people working together, either for good or for ill, and certainly individual destiny is created by the energy that we put out together.
Yes.
We can influence our own destiny enormously. I think there's greater forces at work than just people voting or acting futures into existence. I think the futures are determined by forces greater than, as I say, the human ego. But the
yes.
human ego can expand and participate in that. But I think it's necessary to understand the extent to which you have to transcend the ego to participate in that.
Yes, I agree with you there.
Good.
Now, you also make a wonderful statement that I love, be the change you wish to see in the world.
Yes,
I think that's
exactly.
extremely good advice.
Yes, exactly. That you know, that goes right back to the laws of attraction.
Yes.
I this often comes up when people will... I've done a lot of marriage counseling over the years. You know, relationships is an area in our society right now in which everything is quite confused and people struggle a lot. So that's one area that I personally have put a lot of time and energy into over the years. And very often a single person will come to me very lonely, you know, wanting a life partner and working so hard to try to get one, or not working hard to try to get one, but just hoping.
Yes,
what Swami Kriyananda has taught us, and everything that I know I learned from him, have learned from him, am learning from him, he's still actively teaching, is it's instead of visualizing the form of what you want, you should visualize the energy and the consciousness you want to experience. So a person will say, I want a life partner, but what they really want, they want friends. They want to have a sense of a flow of love in their life. They're looking for appreciation. If they're more noble in their spirit, they're looking to be able to serve someone, to be able to give. And so I always say to them, instead of telling me that you want a life partner, tell me what kind of energy you want to have flowing through you. And then let's figure out how we can get that energy flowing now. Because if you can get that energy flowing, two things will happen. One, you will activate the laws of attraction because you will get on the wavelength of what you want your future to look like instead of just sitting on the sidelines hoping it'll be delivered to you. And the second thing is, if you get that energy and consciousness flowing through you now, the form won't matter to you nearly as much because you'll have it. And often that requires creativity, initiative, courage. But of course, that's why we're here. We weren't put on this earth to just get a free ride. It's not a sit on the boat and ride the current. You know, it's not the kind of world this is. This is a world in which you have to struggle in order to learn and grow. And
yes.
the sooner you get into the game, the more likely it is that the possible prizes will be delivered to you.
Yes.
Although the prize is actually the effort you put out.
Yes. You have some special feelings about what people call holidays, and I gather that you believe it would better be to refine them as holy days, which you believe would give us time for deeper communion with the divine spirit.
Yes, exactly. You know, so much of the unhappiness that I see in the world around me is because people have moved so far away from core values. And, you know, there's the idea, especially, you know, people were having less money this last Christmas, that, oh, suddenly the holiday, which had always been defined by extravagant spending, that was not an option, so what should we do? So the obvious origin of the word holiday is holy.
Hmm.
And holy means that which puts you, I mean, has a double meaning, H-O-L-Y or W-H-O. It makes you whole again. And so
yes.
what are we separated from? We're separated from a reality greater than our just own isolated sense of ego. And, I have a few sort of mantras, so to speak, that I'm always recommending to people. One is slow down. The other is quiet down.
Mm.
I was getting gas yesterday at just in a regular gas station, and they're playing loud and to my ears quite raucous music while I pump my gas, as if I had to be alone with myself for the duration of the time it took me to fill my car with gas, that somehow I would just die of boredom. But the difficulty is all that constant assault of noise, whether it's machines or music or television or radio, sound, we're made of sound waves, and those sound waves just go right through us. And if it's, so we're constantly being bombarded with all this thought and energy and noise that doesn't have anything to do with us. And we really get quite lost in it. A person doesn't even know who they are. And so we ourselves, you go in, you turn on the television and the radio as soon as you go in. You're not even listening. You're just having more noise.
Yes.
So I think the first rule of a holy day is quiet. Just turn off everything. Turn off the cell phone, even unplug the email. Turn off every television and radio. And the only sounds you bring in are consciously brought in that are harmonizing to your spirit. And of course, if there's not a lot of noise around and you're not distracting yourself, people will actually, like, for example, talk to each other. Parents can actually talk to their children. Children can actually talk to their parents. And then I think it's wonderful to, if you're not connected to some spiritual community that defines your relationship with higher consciousness, then create your own. You know, get your family together, or your friends, whatever constitutes your little tribe, and talk together about what's meaningful, or have each person bring something that's meaningful, and share on a consciously determined, slightly ritualized, so that people will feel comfortable on a deeper
right.
level.
Yes.
It can
yes.
transform everything. Yeah. What we can.
Oh. I agree, yes. I was going to ask you what your definition was of happiness.
Of happiness, that's a very good question. I think happiness is an inner sense of rightness, of a feeling that I am exactly who I should be, and I'm right where I should be. An absence of the thought that somehow things have to be different than they are for me to feel content within myself. I think happiness is the awareness that I'm not alone in this world, and I don't mean just because I have children or a husband, that I'm not alone in this world because there is a conscious, benevolent, loving force that is keeping me company at all times. I think the deeper we're in touch with that, many people find that first through nature. But what they're really experiencing is the power that created nature. And that's what happiness is to me. I would, in English you don't have distinguishing words, but the word ananda, actually, which is Sanskrit, means bliss, but it means the inward experience of my own nature as bliss, rather than just, oh, I'm happy because I got the promotion. Because that kind of happiness you can experience anywhere, and it's the source of the remarkable stories you hear about people who are, you know, very ill or have great tragedies in their life or are caught in horrible circumstances like war or concentration camp, where sometimes they will still tell you that somehow because it was so terrible, they were forced to go inside themselves, and inside themselves they discovered like this kernel of happiness that was independent of everything. And that to me is the only thing worth striving for, because everything else leaves you so vulnerable. And the good news about this is that it's not all or nothing. It's not like you have nothing and then you have everything. It's like as soon as you turn your attention toward that level of inner happiness, everything in your life begins to get better. That's what happened to me when I met Swami Kriyananda in 1969. I had so much energy and determination, I didn't know anything. I didn't have any idea what to do with it. And what I wanted above all was to be happy. And nobody could tell me how. They told me to, you know, get this degree and get this job and get this money and get this status. But none of it looked to me like it was going to make me happy in the way I was talking about. And I met Swami Kriyananda. He was 44 years old at that time. I was 22. He walked into that room at Stanford University. He was just at the beginning of building these communities. Now he's a worldwide spiritual teacher. Then he was relatively unknown. He walked in, and I still to this day don't know how. It was just pure intuition. I looked at him, and the first thing I could feel was that his consciousness did not have borders. Most people, you know, it's really their aura or whatever you call it. You can kind of draw a circle around them. But I couldn't find the edge of his awareness. His awareness just seemed to go out way beyond what I could grasp. Mm-hmm. And the second thing was I could feel that his whole aura was inner happiness. And I just somehow knew that he had gotten there deliberately and that he could teach me how to get there. Mm-hmm. And that now it is literally 40 years, almost, a couple of months short of 40 years. And it has just proved true. You know, and what he knew wasn't just him, it was what he'd learned from his guru, Yogananda, what Yogananda learned from the ancient traditions of India, which are the same as the ancient traditions of Christianity or Judaism, which is you have this inner core, and you can do anything you want in your life. You can be the same person. You can be a movie star. You can be a millionaire. You can be a bum on the street. But you can also do this, which is attune yourself to your inner happiness, and then everything else is different because of that.
Yes. It was interesting to read, as you are talking about the Swami, that when you heard him speak for the first time, you immediately recognized him as your spiritual guide.
Yeah. You have to factor in reincarnation. That's the only thing I can figure. I do accept reincarnation, or I've come to accept it.
Yes.
But, you know, all of us have experiences that the only explanation is that even though it seems to be starting at this point, that you're actually, it's just the next chapter of a longer book.
Hmm.
You know, that if there's just too much familiarity. When I met my husband, I had that same feeling about him just instantly. Many people fall in love at first sight, or you have antipathy. You meet somebody and you really can't stand them.
Yes.
But if you think of the fact that you have had relationships before, and I mean, what happens if a couple have been devoted to each other and have lived together for 50 years, and then one dies and then the other dies? And then imagine if they meet again as children. Imagine that they have gone to the astral worlds and then they have reincarnated and they meet again as children. And they're going to be so familiar to each other, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Because the essential consciousness is there. And when you think in spiritual terms, you know, I've devoted myself to these teachings for 4 decades, and I feel like just the merest beginner. I was speaking to a friend of similar experience this morning, and I was saying, you know, the more you get in deeply into spiritual teaching, it's infinite. So the smaller you feel in relationship to it. Not that I haven't experienced enormous benefit and total transformation, I have, but I also see how far there is to go. And so I can only imagine that a teacher like Swami Kriyananda, who's much more advanced than I, he's been working with me for a long time.
Yes,
I'm sure that, I mean, well, I know for a fact, when he walked into that room and I essentially said, oh, there you are, or I said it more like, oh, there you are. I was so happy. I didn't even know I was looking for it. It wasn't like I was on a quest for a teacher. I just wanted help. And somebody suggested I go hear him speak, but as soon as he walked in, I said, he had done what I wanted to do. I knew what I wanted to do, and I couldn't find anybody to help me.
Yeah.
But then he was gone. And, you know, some people have it quickly, some grow to it slowly, just like some people fall in love instantly. Some people grow to love the person they spend their life with. Mm. You know, it's just personal.
That's a very wonderful story. And I like your suggestion about spending time outside.
I think one of the things... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think that finding happiness, possibly, by understanding nature, you suggest looking at a forest or an ocean or a park. There's something available to people, isn't there, by understanding what there is around them.
And also, you know, there's a natural harmony. I mean, nature can be also quite fierce, but there's a natural rhythm to the natural world, and I think among many reasons why people are having collectively such a hard time is that we're so seldom in the natural world. We're so seldom close to a tree or just on the ground, you know, lying on the ground or even looking at a flower. And there's so much consciousness that's in harmony. It's sort of like if you're trying to learn a song, if somebody sings it properly for you, it's much easier to learn. And so when we're trying to be in harmony even with ourselves, if you're with these simpler forms of life relative to a human ego, they're simpler because they don't have as many conflicting cross currents of personal desire, and that makes them much simpler. It simplifies us. You lean up against the bark of a tree, and there's an actual consciousness in there that just simply does its job. That knows who it is. It does its job. It does its job in harmony with the natural flow of things. It is as much a part of divine creation as a human being is. It's just standing in a different relationship to it, and it helps us to, like, hear the right note. And you don't have to have a whole forest. You can have a square inch of lawn, you know, or you can have a philodendron. You can just have one small thing if you actually communicate with it.
Yes, I think that's an excellent tip. Now, time is racing by here, and I do want to talk about some of your special tips for staying balanced during stressful times. And I think a lot of people have an interest in the idea you are what you eat. So give us your views about that.
Well, you know, there's a lot of publicity about that now. I started as a vegetarian in 1967 when my family thought I would starve to death and die. So it's been a long time.
Yeah.
You know, people are not conscious of how much their mental state is influenced by their diet. And when you take food of any kind into your body, it takes a certain amount of energy to digest it, and you're basically having a trade-off. It's, you spend energy digesting the food, and the hope is that it will then give you more energy than it takes to digest it. But what we're actually trying to take in is life force, just a way to say it. So if you take in something that's completely devitalized, which is that whatever original life force it had has been processed out of it, there's no vitality in it. Now, people can talk about vitamins and so on like that. That's one way to say it. I'm simplifying it even farther to just life force. So if you constantly eat things that have no life force, and I, as an example that I offered there is if you take a Big Mac, a hamburger from McDonald's, and you bury it in the ground, it will just putrefy. Nothing will come of it. If you take an apple and put it in the ground, a new living plant will grow from that. If you take a grain of rice and you bury it, you'll get thousands and thousands of grains of rice from it. And all of that life force is inherent within that food. So essentially, if you need to eat that which is alive. And people go quite far, you know, they don't cook, they pick the garden vegetables and eat them immediately. You don't have to go that far. But if what you're holding in your hand resembles where it was made, what it looked like when it was made, and if it anything that has a shelf life of forever, you should be really, really wary of, because if it doesn't rot, that means it's already dead. If it has any life at all, it will rot. And so then you eat stuff like that, and all it does is simply just takes and takes and takes energy from you. And it clogs up your system, it clogs up your brain, and you have no vitality. And if you have no energy, you can't do anything. But, I know people can't change all at once. So what I encourage is just start. Start trying to choose foods that have vital energy. And shift, if you can't get rid of what you shouldn't eat, at least add in something that you should. Grow your own, of course, is the best, or buy it from people who've just grown it. Cook it as little as possible so that it retains. You can cook the food, but you should still be able to recognize it when it's finished.
Are you saying that it is better to eat fresh fruit and vegetables? Is that the message, really?
Well, yes. I think the closer, the more vital it is, the closer it is to the point where it was still growing. You know, a carrot in the ground is still growing, an apple on the tree is still growing, which is to say the life force is still vital. You take the apple off the tree, it's no longer growing, so you should eat it as close to the time when it was vital as you could. By the time you're getting a ground-up hamburger, the poor cow is long since dead. The meat itself is probably, you know, begun to degenerate. I mean, they age it in certain ways, but you can see the life force is gone by that point. A white bread hamburger bun, you know, you just squeeze it in your hand and it's just a piece of sponge. It doesn't have anything, any juice, and it doesn't have any natural sweetness. You know, it's just gone. So yes, vital and alive. But I know food for people is a very complicated issue. So you have to be practical in your idealism. If you push yourself too far, you'll just bounce back. And I'm no fanatic. I have been a fanatic, but I'm not a fanatic anymore. I eat chocolate.
No.
You know, I eat chocolate. I eat in restaurants. I eat cooked food, but I always try to get as much life force as possible in whatever I eat.
Yes. Have you found over your years that it has kept you healthy?
I have remarkable health. I'm 62. I've never had a serious illness. I've never been in the hospital. By the grace of God, and I say by the grace of God, absolutely. Personally, I've enjoyed extraordinarily good health, energy, and vitality. Even at this age, I can do just about anything that I want to do, and I can work, and my mind is clearer. I can feel the difference, and I don't have a weight problem. Just all those things. Water is also important, I would also add.
Yes,
if you're not going to eat good food, at least drink water. Much of the unwellness of people is because they're deeply and profoundly dehydrated. I mean, really dehydrated, like decades of dehydration. The synapses of our brain happen in the medium of water, and if you're dehydrated, you can't think. Somebody said the best thing you can do for your child's education is to teach the child to drink water. Have the child drink two glasses of water before their exam, and they'll do much better on their test.
I can believe that, absolutely. Now, tell us what you mean by the original.
Oh, that's a lovely thought, isn't it? You know, people talk about being creative a lot of the time, and Swami Kriyananda defined originality as to do that which emanates from your own point of origin. And your own point of origin is the divine spirit within you. And that doesn't mean in any way you have to be unique or different than other people. It just means that whatever you do needs to be a deeply sincere expression of your own perception of truth. Whether it's music or just the words that you speak or the dinner that you make or the color of towels that you buy. You just need to live your life from an inner sense of this is who I am. And of course, sometimes you have to experiment because we're not deeply trained to know who we are. We're deeply trained to reflect the society around us. But, of course, if you get deeply into your sense of origin, then, in fact, you may become tremendously original in the way people generally mean that, which is that your self-expression will be uniquely your own. And the best art, the best music, the best writing all comes from, at the end, a person will say later, I mean, I feel that way about the book I wrote about Swami Kriyananda. I know I wrote that book. I mean, I typed it. I know the words.
Mm.
At the same time, I felt that I was in touch with a deeper part of myself that made it come through me rather than my doing it myself. So I look at the book, and I love the book. I can even say, oh, it's a wonderful book without any sense of personal involvement in it because I felt like it really came from my point of origin, and my point of origin is not my ego.
Yes, yes.
So no, very, creatively speaking, it's a wonderful way to be.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And I think you also said in that same context to be sincere in everything that you do.
Sincerity is really a deeply important and often undervalued virtue. Sincerity means that you really mean it. You're not just using those words, you're not just putting on a face. But whatever it is that you're doing, it's an authentic expression of your consciousness. I think if there was more sincerity in the world, it would be a much happier place. That doesn't mean that you speak unkindly just because you're annoyed with someone, because truth is also kind. But that means that if you are annoyed with something, you have to think creatively to be able to say something kind that's also sincere. You know, I've learned over the years to be able to be quite supportive of people, very positive, but also deeply sincere. And, you know, it gives such an integrity to your relationships because people then know that you will, whatever you say will be true.
Right.
And they'll rely on you. I've had the gratification of sometimes people saying, you know, let's ask Asha because she'll really tell us the truth about this.
That's lovely,
they feel confident that I'll be supportive enough that they don't have to be afraid of what I'm going to say, but they also feel confident that I will tell them the truth. I mean, just in a little thing, like a 13-year-old girl was insecure about her hairdo for a special party. Her mother brought her to me. What do you think? Asha will tell us the truth. And, you know, I did. And I helped her because she trusted me. That's a tremendous thing in life to have people.
That's lovely, yeah. Now, I've got to come round to asking you to let our listeners know what your website address is, where presumably they can obtain further details about your book, because we only have a few minutes left. So would you like to tell us the site address and any other little bits of information about it?
Thank you. I appreciate that. You can actually find us in a lot of different ways. If you go to As We Have Known Him, my book is Swami Kriyananda, As We Have Known Him. The website is simply aswehavekknownhim.com. You can also look up my name, Asha, A-S-H-A, Praver, P-R-A-V-E-R, ashapraver.com or .org. Also, you can look up Ananda, A-N-A-N-D-A, Ananda.org or AnandaPaloAlto.org gets you right to where everything that I'm doing is located. Just start anywhere. Use the name Asha, or As We Have Known Him will take you to all of it. Okay?
That's fine. Yeah. You only have the websites you've mentioned. There are no additional ones.
No, those
That's
are the
it.
Ones.
Right, yeah, okay. They will appear on my archive write-up on BBS Radio, so if anybody's missed it listening to you, hopefully they can pick it up there.
Great.
But it's been extremely nice to have you on. You certainly have a lot of what I would call spiritual knowledge, and it's very interesting to hear you express it in the way you do.
Thank you. I've enjoyed talking to you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
And I would remind our listeners that what we have been speaking about today is, of course, contained in the book that we've been talking about. So the book will enlarge upon these ideas and the things we've been talking about. So thank you very much for coming onto the program. I'll take the last minute or so to announce my guest for next week. I'm sure everybody's enjoyed hearing you speak. It was really marvellous. Thank you again.
Thank you, Michael. Okay.
Very
bye
welcome.
Bye.
Right, my friends, that was yet another very interesting talker. Next week I have Sheila and Marcus Gillette, who are teachers, who have written a book called The Soul Truth, A Guide to Inner Peace. And it covers the conversations with Theo, which is the name given to a channeled consortium of 12 archangels who are looking out to reach spiritual seekers. So that again, I think, will prove to be a very interesting interview. So I'm sure you enjoyed today's interview, and I hope you can be with me next week. It looks as though it's going to be a really interesting program. So thank you for being with me. God bless you all.